Hello and welcome to New Books in African Studies. I'm your host, Nicholas Walton. In every program, we talk about a new book that looks at some aspect of Africa and hear from the author. In this episode, that book is Chocolate Nations, Living and Dying for Cocoa in West Africa. And the author is Orla Ryan. Chocolate is, of course, an enormously symbolic product, a symbol of luxury in the developed world and of commodity production in the developing world. Campaigning groups have focused on cocoa growing for supposed problems such as child slavery, and schemes such as fair trade have been trumpeted as providing solutions to some of those problems. All in all, it's a fascinating subject, and this book is well worth reading. But first, of course, I hope you enjoy the interview. Sitting opposite me here in Westminster is Orla Ryan, the author of Chocolate Nations, Living and Dying for Cocoa in West Africa. Hello.
Hello, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. This is it's a fascinating book about something that, to be honest, we all know we take for granted, and what lies behind a very well-known product, a commodity, etc., and how it comes about and all of the different issues involved in its production, in growing cocoa in the first place, and how it actually affects the countries and the communities within which it's grown. So before we actually get to discuss some of the things in the book itself, why don't you just start off just telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got so interested in this subject?
Okay, I'm a journalist, and I have been a journalist for nearly 20 years. And in 2005, I accepted a job with Reuters to work in Ghana. And one of the reasons that Reuters is so interested in having a reporter in Ghana, which is a small country in West Africa, is that it's the world's second biggest producer of cocoa. And obviously, most people know Reuters because it's a general news agency, but it makes a lot of its money by selling financial news or commodities news. And this makes Ghana very interesting for Reuters, because Ghana produced 1 million tonnes of cocoa last year. That's out of a world crop of 3.5 million tonnes. So if you subscribe to the Reuters service or the Bloomberg service or one of those, you're very interested in knowing about supply and production in Ghana, because that could influence the price of cocoa on the market in New York and the market in London. So if there's a strike at a port in Ghana, if the weather is really bad in Ghana, all these things could influence the crop and could influence deliveries. And ultimately, this can influence the price. So if you subscribe to the Reuters news service, this is the kind of information you want to have.
So when you were in Ghana, just out of interest, what kind of proportion of your time was spent monitoring things connected to chocolate or cocoa, rather?
God, that's a good question. I always felt that a disproportionate amount of time was spent trying to get information on cocoa. I mean, if you looked at the stories that ended up in The Wire, there wasn't necessarily that many stories on cocoa that ended up in The Wire, but I spent an awful lot of time trying to get the information because it was incredibly sensitive.
All right.
You know, this is this is the country's biggest export earner. You know, there's a saying, cocoa is Ghana, Ghana is cocoa. They take it very, very seriously. The Ghana Cocoa Marketing Board, which runs the sector, don't like speaking to journalists. They don't like speaking to Reuters. I don't think they particularly liked speaking to me. They knew that what I reported could move the market price. They felt this could never be in their interest. So I felt I spent a lot of time trying to understand the industry. And while at first, if I'm honest, when I got there, I sort of thought, you know, there's far more interesting things than cocoa to write about. You know, this is just bean counting. Maybe it was because it was so difficult to get the information, and maybe it was because I had to work so hard to understand it. But I realized that this was a way, that learning about cocoa was offering me an insight into Ghana that more obvious general news stories, such as about politics or, I don't know, I know the cocoa is the economy, but about the broader economy, they somehow, even though cocoa was sort of quite niche, it seemed to offer me sort of this insight into the way that sort of Ghana worked. And I ended up finding it quite fascinating. But yes, I spent a lot of time trying to get this information. I'm not sure how successful I was. But, a lot of time trying to get information in, you know, which in a lot of times was actually quite mundane. You know, I would go down to the Cocoa Marketing Board and I would, you know, ask them if the weather would affect the crop this year. And, you know, you're essentially asking people, you know, what's the weather like? You know, this is sort of normal conversation in the UK, but, you know, they would react as if I'd asked them if the sky was about to fall in. And because they could see where, as a journalist, I could be going with this.
Yes.
And what this could mean for the cocoa price. Mm-hmm. You know, and I guess as a journalist, as you realise that people sort of, you know, are very sensitive about this and they take it very seriously, you're wondering, like, well, what's there? You know, why is this so, why is this sort of so important? Or so, why are you so defensive about this? So that's kind of how I got into it. And I guess as a way, because the guys at the Cocoa Marketing Board in Accra, which is the capital of Ghana, were very sensitive and wouldn't give me any information, I had to do a lot of legwork, which is obviously very good journalism. I went to the bush to speak to farmers and, you know, buyers and people who worked up country, because if I couldn't get the information in Accra, I had to sort of go to the source to get it. And I went and I spoke to farmers and spoke to buyers. And, you know, that, in a way, I think that's really kind of what inspired me to write the book, because once you get into the bush and once you're speaking to farmers and once you see where they live, you know, the contrast between, if you think of where I came from, I was hired by Reuters to write about commodity markets. And, you know, the commodity markets in London are essentially a busy trade. Well, I don't know if the commodity markets in London are a lot of flickering screens with data on it. That's the London cocoa market. When you get to Ghana, the cocoa market in Ghana is all these villages, you know, which, you know, many of them are essentially made up of mud huts with straw roofs, sometimes tin roofs if the farmer's better off. The farmers don't have running water, they don't have electricity. There may or may not be a school in the village. The children often have to walk far to get to school. These farmers don't eat chocolate. They've never really heard of chocolate. Cocoa isn't something which is used locally. It's an imported crop. It's a million miles away, not just literally, but in figuratively, in every sense you could possibly imagine, from, in a way, both the London commodity markets and also sort of the industry that you or I grew up with, which is, you know, Cadbury's milk tray, the Cadbury's cream egg, it's Easter, or, you know, Valentine's Day, all these occasions which, you know, where chocolate is a really big part of it, and all the imagery and decadence and what have you that goes with chocolate. And this was where it was all coming from. And without if these farmers didn't do what they were doing, none of this would exist.
Absolutely.
Absolutely none of this would exist. We wouldn't have this big chocolate industry. These commodity markets, you know, would have nothing to trade. It all came down to what these farmers were doing. And as far as I could see, they had absolutely nothing to show for it. Mm. So, you know, so it was that. I wanted to explore the reasons around that. And as you know, as I said, the fact that politically and economically it was so important in Ghana, that just sort of kind of fired my interest a bit more.
Mm, it gives certainly in the book, it comes across just the multidimensional nature of something that eventually ends up as a couple of figures on some commodity markets, as you say.
Because I think before I went to Ghana, I'd often heard the phrase of, you know, about a particular crop or a particular commodity such as gold or copper, what have you. It's the economic lifeblood of a country. And then when I got to Ghana, I actually really understood what that meant. Because, you know, there's 800,000, I think it's 800,000, let's say 800,000 farmers in Ghana. Let's say they have sort of dependents of 4 or 5 each. That's 4 or 5 million people in a country of 20 million people. You know, the busiest time of the year is October to December. When they sell their beans, those villages have a lot of money. The whole, you know, prices start going up in the market. Everything is shaken up by the arrival of sort of the cocoa money. And, you know, cocoa is sort of the country's biggest export. Ghana, it exports gold, it exports, you know, it has other commodities that it exports, but cocoa is the one that is seen as sort of keeping the country together because it influences so many small people. And it was a really fascinating insight and a real shock to see how this worked on the ground.
Mm. One phrase that you use in the book, which I really appreciated, was you said it was a real life lesson in economics.
Yes, yes.
Did you know much economics before you went, or was this your...
No, I knew some, but I'd written business stories before. I'd been a business journalist, but I don't think you understand it. This was very much the hard end of it. Mm-hmm. This wasn't, I think prior to going, I could have deciphered a company report and, you know, I could have interviewed a sort of an executive, but this was very much the hard end of it. And, you know, it was so closely related to something that I felt that I knew quite well. But when I got to, you know, the chocolate industry, just I felt I knew it quite well as a consumer. And actually, when I got there, I realised I didn't know anything about it at all. I mean, one of the things that I found when I was writing the book, people would often, you know, say I was writing about cocoa and people would assume that I was spending a lot of time in South America. And I was like, no, you know, most of the world's cocoa comes from West Africa. Mm-hmm. And it was one of the things that, you know, was sort of really really, in a way, quite shocking. People don't even know the countries that this comes from. You know, there's a tiny number of chocolate bars, you know, where the beans are sort of sourced from Venezuela. And they might be premium chocolate bars, or they might be, you know, quite well known. But the vast majority of chocolate bars that you eat, they're beans, you know, they will be made with beans from sort of from West Africa. And most people don't know that.
And that's Côte d'Ivoire as well as Ghana.
Yes.
Are they the two big producers?
Yeah. Côte d'Ivoire is the world's biggest producer. Ghana is the world's second biggest producer. And West Africa as a whole, and this would include Cameroon and Nigeria, produce over 2 million tonnes a year. And that's out of a world crop of 3.5 million.
One thing I'm very interested in, and you've already mentioned this a bit, but the figure that you've got in the book is that there's only 3% of global sales of chocolate are in Middle East and North Africa. You're saying that you're saying that a lot of the people who grow cocoa not only have never tried chocolate, but they have very little conception of what chocolate is.
Yeah, no, that's very true.
Did you ever go to one of these places and actually try and explain or maybe even offer them chocolate or something like that and say, this is where it all ends up?
I think I would have found that quite patronising to do that.
I understand.
I think farmers aren't stupid. They understand that there's a demand for this in the West and they understand that it's made into a good. And I think it's quite hard to explain the kind of the industry that's grown up in the Europe and the US around chocolate, the kind of, you know, the tempting treat, you know, something, you know, the, it's all the imagery that's sort of consistent with chocolate and sort of the heavy advertising and, you know, the Easter egg industry, sort of the Valentine's present. You know, I think, I'm sure, you know, like I said, farmers aren't stupid. They understand that this is, you know, this is a crop that sort of people use to make a good that people want to buy. But I think it's quite hard to sort of convey what chocolate means in our culture.
And symbolise it. It symbolises luxury.
What is it, this sort of idea of sort of luxury and decadence and all those things sort of that sort of chocolate, you know, has come to sort of represent in the West. I think for them, cocoa is simply cash. Mm-hmm. You know, it's they can't eat it, they sell it, you know. So, but I mean, it's quite, when you go into cocoa villages in the busiest time of year, October to December, you know, the smell of sort of chocolate is really rich. And it's so strange because this, you know, you have that rich smell of chocolate, like when you're melting it on the cooker or, you know, sometimes you know that scent. And it brings to mind certain things for me. But for farmers and people in those villages, this just means it's the busy time of year. And, you know, this is when people will come to buy the beans. It doesn't, you know, the imagery, you know, the associations are completely different.
Let's just stick with the farmers at the minute. Can you just give us an idea of what it is like as a crop to grow and to earn your living from? Because obviously, you know, everyone talks about something like sugar cane being a particularly difficult thing to earn a living through. But what's it like for the farmers being dependent upon the cocoa crop? And what's their life like?
Well, the crop is a native to West Africa and it's known as being a very sensitive crop. It's very sensitive to disease. There's a tiny band around the world that you can grow cocoa in. I think it's about 10 or 15 degrees on each side of the equator that has the right, you know, the right temperatures, the right kind of humidity, the right kind of soil. And it's generally a crop that's flourished as a smallholder crop. It isn't sort of grown in plantations anywhere in the world. So it's seen as a crop that's sensitive, that needs a lot of care, that it works as a smallholder crop. When you go to a cocoa farm, the trees are all sort of quite densely packed together. It's quite difficult to tell where one farm ends and another begins. I could never tell, though farmers would always say, oh, so-and-so starts over there. A cocoa pod is generally about the size of a rugby ball, though I'm sure people could question my use of that description, but I would think of it as being a ripe one as maybe slightly smaller.
20 centimetres or so,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
8 inches perhaps.
Yeah, and it's unripe, it's green. They come from sort of tiny white flowers which are called chirelles, and they then blossom into pods. And they start off sort of green pods and then they grow into sort of yellow or purple pods, and that's when they're ripe. And a farmer would sort of chop them down with a machete, slice them and then scoop out all these white beans and then leave them to ferment on reed trays for 6 or 7 days. And it's this fermentation process that is meant to give sort of Ghanaian cocoa beans their sort of distinctive taste. I mean, Cadbury has built the taste. The taste of Cadbury's chocolate is the taste of Ghanaian cocoa beans. Cadbury's mm-hmm. gets all its cocoa from Ghana. So it's this sort of fermentation process where they sort of leave the beans out for 6 or 7 days, turn them twice, that sort of allows that sort of cocoa smell to, that cocoa that cocoa taste to develop, or that particularly distinctive cocoa taste to develop. And then the farmers load them into bags and take them to the nearest buying station. Mm-hmm. I've always thought whenever I visited farms, I always thought this is a very hard life. Mm-hmm. Though often farmers within their communities would be seen as being relatively quite well off, because obviously at certain times of the year, between October and December, they would have 3 or 4 bags of cocoa, maybe worth $100 each, which they would get that money, $400, which relatively speaking can be quite a lot. But then that money, they might lease the land. Mm-hmm. So maybe a third would go to the landlord. Then there's money they will have borrowed throughout the year, which they will then pay back. So that money can disappear incredibly quickly, even though it can be a lot of money to get at one time of the year. Usually between October and December is sort of when the cocoa money arrives. So it's not a job where you have a monthly salary.
Mm-hmm. And you say that it's something that fluctuates a lot dependent on weather, as we were saying when we were talking when you first got that. So it sounds as though, I don't want to use, perhaps the word resilient. Are the farmers quite resilient to change and fluctuations? Or is it one of those things that your income flies up one year and collapses the next year?
I think farmers can be quite vulnerable to sudden changes in the price. Mm-hmm. It depends on how diversified their farms are. You can certainly make the argument that most farms are not actually that diversified. They're very over-reliant on cocoa. So yes, a bad crop can really devastate a farmer. A sharp drop in the price can really devastate a farmer. And has a huge impact for the farmer, his or her family, and sort of the wider community, as mm-hmm. well as just the Ghanaian treasury and the money that arrives in there. Mm-hmm. It has that huge impact on a very local level. I mean, it's certainly a hard... You definitely do meet farmers who've done quite well out of it. You definitely do meet farmers who... They might have a sort of a small mud dwelling in the village where they farm, but they've managed over the years to make enough money to buy a house in a town nearby. So you definitely do meet farmers who've done quite well out of it. They tend to be bigger farmers who've more farms, who maybe own some land as well as leasing land. But for the vast majority of farmers, when I met them, I was always struck by, this is a very hard life.
Mm. And what about when you move up a level from the farms and you get towards the, as you were, marketing boards, the political level? When you've got a country that's so dependent upon something like cocoa, what has it done to Ghana over the years?
Right.
Big question, sorry.
Because it's a big question, it's a broad answer. Mm-hmm. I would generally think that cocoa has been quite good to Ghana.
Mm-hmm.
Because there can be a tendency to sort of see commodities just in terms of exploitation. Because I thought quite carefully about the title for the book, and I really wanted, they're living and dying for cocoa in West Africa. When I say they're living for it, it's actually given people an income.
Mm-hmm.
There's definitely a side to it, particularly in Côte d'Ivoire, where it's been quite bloody, it's been quite brutal, it's been very murky. But in lots of ways, the crop has been quite good to Ghana. I think often when you talk to Ghanaians, I mean, since Ghana got independence in 1957 and is the first country on the African continent to get, well, actually, Egypt. The first country in sub-Saharan Africa to get independence.
Mm-hmm.
They followed there was a succession of coups. There were some quite rough years through the sort of the 60s and 70s. And in that time, sort of Ghana really was the country's only export. It was its one source of foreign exchange. And when you talk to people from that era, particularly people who were sort of in government or in the marketing board in that era, they talk about it like that cocoa kept the country together, mm-hmm. that the money from that came the country together. Kept the money they earned from cocoa kept the country together, and they also had a lot of barter arrangements with Cuba. They swapped cocoa for sugar and this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So I think historically, and that sort of, there's that sense that cocoa has done a lot for Ghana. There's also, which I guess helps explain the sort of the protectiveness around it. I think when you think of what cocoa means for Ghana now, there are a lot of questions about where Ghana goes from here, because Ghana is still essentially a producer of a raw crop. It's mm-hmm. not adding value in Ghana. It's Ghana's recently become sort of, Ghana is Africa's newest oil producer. Ghana needs to think about where it goes forward with cocoa from here. Mm. It's a very difficult situation for Ghana to be in. There are 800,000 farmers in Ghana. They make their living from the sale of cocoa beans. You need to think about how you modernise the industry, how you can improve yields, how you can improve these farmers' incomes. And often, if you were to look at that in a sort of cold-hearted, sort of straightforwardly logical way, then you would question, should you have 800,000 farmers with 5 hectares each farming this land? Mm-hmm. Shouldn't you just have 200,000 farmers with maybe bigger farms and then, properly managed with higher yields, running them actually as a business rather than this smallholder sharecropper way. Mm. But then you have to start thinking about what do all these other people do, where in a way cocoa has provided, I always felt it provided some sort of a basic social net, provided a basic net for the country. It was almost like welfare. Mm-hmm. That sort of, as long as the cocoa money was coming in, there was some money coming into the company and coming into the country and coming in at a grassroots level. It was, you can have a gold mine, you can mine for gold, you can sort of sell that gold, and that gold mine will employ 200 people, and the government will take the money from that gold mine and will go to the company and it will go to the treasury. The money from cocoa, the government taxes it quite heavily, but a lot of money goes to an awful lot of people at grassroots level on the ground. Mm-hmm. So it's provided this kind of social net. So it's just the sense, very few countries have ever developed by remaining producers of basic commodities such as cocoa. So it's the sense of where does Ghana see itself going from here? But the reality is that cocoa in lots of ways has been quite good for it.
Is there any way that that Ghana or other growers of cocoa could move up the value chain within the chocolate industry?
Right.
I've heard this mooted by several people. I'm not certain it always sounds like the most sensible thing. For one thing, especially when you end up with the final product, you're looking at something that melts.
Yes.
most obvious point.
Well, if you're talking about sort of making a perishable product in a tropical country where there is no market for that product. So, yeah. And
although the world market is increasing quite quickly, I understand, for cocoa.
Yes, there is demand for cocoa. Demand for cocoa is quite strong. I think demand for cocoa in Ghana, and demand for chocolate products in Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire and even within the rest of Africa is in tiny, limited, minuscule. Mm-hmm. But if you're a chocolate producer, you would think you would want, if you're a chocolate maker rather, you would want to make that perishable product close to your end consumers. Mm-hmm. And Ghana or Cote d'Ivoire are not close to their end consumers. And also, there is one guy, Steve Wallace, an American guy who does make chocolate in Ghana, Omanhini chocolate. And I've met him a few times and I write about him in the book. And, his joke was when he first had this idea of wanting to make chocolate in Ghana, his big fear was, I guess like any entrepreneur, that, what if somebody gets there before me? I really want to be the first guy to do this. And, however many years later, as he's been sort of slogging away at this, he has many fears, but he doesn't fear that anyone else is going to want to do this. Because he knows exactly how difficult it is. But
that's a feedback mechanism in itself for entrepreneurs.
Yes, but you know, I think there's no dairy industry in West Africa as such. Mm-hmm. So I think he gets his milk from New Zealand. There is a sugar industry, but I don't think he gets his sugar from within Ghana. Power is incredibly expensive. Mm-hmm. And it's much cheaper to export beans than it is to export a finished perishable product. Mm-hmm. Packaging is very difficult to get, you know. And then it's very difficult. He then, as a small entrepreneur starting out by himself, he also found it quite difficult to sort of to get on supermarket shelves in the US. It's definitely a very appealing idea. I mean, if you break down, I think if you break down the cost of a chocolate bar, if it's the chocolate bar cost a pound, I think 7 pence is spent on ingredients and 43 pence goes to the manufacturer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Ghana and Cote d'Ivoire aren't getting any of that much larger share, which is manufacturing. They're just getting the tiny bit, which is sort of spent on ingredients. But I find it very hard to believe that, I think it's quite an attractive idea to think that the way forward would be for them to make chocolate in, you know, would be for Ghana and Ivory Coast to make chocolate locally. But I don't actually really think it makes sense, you know.
I've got a question you may or may not be able to answer, but every so often someone talks about trying to market chocolate in the same way that you might be able to market some other fine foods. And of course, you see the effects of this when you go into certain shops in London or whatever. And, you know, they start talking about single source cocoa beans, etc. Do many of these things make a difference, or are they just ways of trying to actually increase the quality of the chocolate in some way, but also market it at a higher level and maybe, you know, be able to shuffle more funds down the chain to in fair trade type of way?
Okay, I tend to think I think anything that encourages people to buy chocolate is probably good for farmers because I tend to think that single source initiatives or initiatives which are about sort of a finer kind of chocolate or a more exclusive kind of chocolate, I tend to think of those as marketing initiatives. It's a way for manufacturers to differentiate themselves on the shelf. Mm. And I tend to think that ultimately they're all quite niche initiatives. You know, the vast majority of bars that are sold are Mars, Twixes, Snickers, and these are the bars, you know, these are the bars which are made from cocoa beans from sort of West Africa. So I think it's good, you know, these kind of marketing initiatives, I guess, encourage people to buy more chocolate or encourage people who might not otherwise eat chocolate to think, you know, oh, this is something I might like. You know, if I don't necessarily like sweet foods, I might like this kind of exclusive chocolate. I kind of tend to think of it as a bit of a red herring in terms of thinking about sort of how you improve farmers' lives.
And I suppose this conversation moves neatly on to the question of fair trade. And fair trade has been obviously increasing in leaps and bounds in terms of the percentage of the market for various things, whether it's chocolate or other commodities grown in especially in the developing world. What are your thoughts about fair trade? Because you address it quite a lot in the book.
Right. Yeah, I guess when I first moved to Ghana, I was certainly quite sort of sympathetic to the idea of fair trade, because I think the narrative is a very compelling one, which is that if I pay a little bit more for this bar of chocolate, then the people who make the chocolate will pay a little bit more to the farmer, and then sort of he's better off. So it's definitely a narrative that I have sympathy with. But I guess when I went to the bush, I find it to be slightly more complicated than that. I think fair trade needs to be understood within the context of the overall Ghanaian market. So the Ghanaian government sets a minimum price for farmers. Mm-hmm. And the minimum price it sets for farmers is, I think, it's about $1,900 a ton. And that's compares with a price on the New York Stock Exchange of about $2,300. Mm-hmm. So the Ghanaian government pays its farmers about well over 70% of the market price, mm-hmm. Which this is actually quite, historically, this is quite unusual. During the 70s and early 80s, farmers could have received 10% of the market price. During the commodities boom in the 70s, I think the cocoa price was $3,000 and farmers are receiving $300 per ton. Mm. Whereas now, what's changed is that since the 70s and 80s, Ghana's had, I think, 5 democratic elections and 2 peaceful handovers of powers, 2 peaceful handovers of power. And in the political situation in Ghana, such as that there's 2 main political parties, the New Patriotic Party, the NPP, and the National Democratic Congress, the NDC. And both of them are fairly evenly matched in terms of support. So there'll be an election in Ghana later this year, and, you know, it's they'll go pretty much head to head. There's no obvious winner. And you have to think again about the fact that there's sort of it's a country with a population of 20 million people. About 4 million of them make their money from cocoa. The government sets the minimum price for cocoa. Mm-hmm. They are now looking, you know, as never before in Ghana's history, they are now looking for farmers' votes. I'm as sure as, I mean, I would think that it's quite likely that going into the election this year, with an election due in December, that when the government sets the price for cocoa farmers in September, October, that they will increase the price they pay to farmers. So the advent of democracy, I feel, has really benefited farmers in Ghana, because the Ghanaian government doesn't feel able to push them around in the same way that they did before. Because before, they'd sell the cocoa for the farmers, tax it as much as they want to, and, you know, keep the cash, and the farmers could maybe get 10% of the price on the international market. And now the Ghanaian government says, you know, every budget, it always says, our plan is to pay farmers the minimum 70% of the world market price for cocoa. And this has been a huge development that... The Ghanaian government can't ignore farmers the way that historically it's been able to, where it just taxes them whatever, because they'll lose out at the ballot box. I mean, they could certainly do an awful lot more for farmers. And you could certainly argue that a farmer who gets 70% of the world market cocoa price is paying a very high tax on his turnover, and he should be receiving more. He should be receiving 85% or 90%. But this has been a huge development and largely unsung. And it's been a Ghanaian development. It's not a development that's come from overseas. It's been a Ghanaian development that sort of the government no longer feels is able to ignore farmers as it once was. And this has sort of improved the lot of the vast majority of Ghana's 800,000 farmers. Mm-hmm. So this is something I applaud. Certainly the Ghanaian government could do an awful lot more for their farmers. They're by no means perfect. But in the sense of there's a definite responsiveness there. So that's the overall, that is the story of the Ghanaian cocoa market over the past sort of 20 years or so. And on the other side, you have fair trade. And fair trade, by comparison, is just a very small initiative which benefits a far smaller number of farmers. And the contrast between what farmers, fair trade farmers get and what farmers who just receive the Ghanaian government minimum is not that great. Mm. I think the fair trade minimum price is $2,000 a ton. There's a social premium on top of that of $200 per ton. But this fair trade has 40,000 farmers who sell 20,000 tons of fair trade cocoa. And I've done the calculation, which if you look at the fair trade premium and if you look at the number of farmers, that means they get about $100 extra per year per farmer. And that's nice. But it affects a small number of farmers compared to the vast number of farmers that have benefited from the moves towards democracy in Ghana and the Ghanaian government's greater responsiveness towards farmers and voters. So I kind of feel in a way that fair trade is a bit of a sideshow. I think fair trade has done some interesting things in Ghana, but I think it's piggybacked on things that the Ghanaian government has done, which is essentially this move towards democracy, this sort of greater responsiveness on the part of the Ghanaian government. So when I sort of see the fair trade narrative, or when I see the fair trade advertising or what have you, I tend to think there's a much bigger story there. Absolutely. You know, there's a much bigger story there. And it's not a story about, you know, us as consumers. It's not a story about fair trade. It's a story about things that the Ghanaians have done for themselves.
at the same time, and this is where it's interesting to bring fair trade back in, fair trade covers a lot of goods all the way through to quite small producers, such as vanilla farmers in other parts of the continent, Uganda, yeah, etc. And perhaps it's fair to say that Ghana, both with its with the success of its democracy, again, if we compare it to Cote d'Ivoire, and with the fact that the cocoa farmers are quite a hefty block of votes for people to court, maybe we're talking about a very, very specific situation? Or do you think that there are things in what you've been describing that that would provide optimistic scenarios for other farmers and producers across right. Africa?
I'm always wary of extrapolating too much because sure. That way lies.
yes.
lies madness. But, I mean, there are some very interesting things about the Ghanaian situation. One is the fact that the Ghanaian government itself does set a minimum price for cocoa, and it can do this because it has a marketing board. Mm-hmm. And marketing boards by themselves are not in and of themselves, you know, a ticket to farmer happiness. It really varies. It really depends on how well they're run. Ghana's always had a marketing board. For decades, it was simply a tool to overtax the farmer. It's no longer simply a tool to overtax the farmer. The thing that, as the marketing board works now, I think it does work quite well for Ghana's 800,000 or so farmers, because while they are a hefty block of farmers individually, you know, they're just a lot of guys who have a couple of hectares each. They can't negotiate with Mars. Ghana does negotiate with Mars.
Mm.
Ghana does negotiate with Cadbury. So I think there are interesting, you know, there's a lot of that's interesting about the Ghanaian scenario, which is that you have this marketing board, which can work as an effective voice for sort of all the country's farmers. And does provide them a lot of support in terms of insecticide and, you know, training and this kind of stuff. But in the past, it hasn't.
Mm.
You know, it's just been literally one more way to, you know, to shaft the farmer. So I think I kind of have a sort of a cautious admiration for marketing boards, if well run. And when you're talking about a lot of smallholders, it can be an effective voice for them.
You draw a comparison or maybe we're not talking about a comparison, but with Côte d'Ivoire, you talk about it being a weak point where such a system hits where such a supply chain hits a corrupt patronage-based political system and its bureaucracy. And you've got a couple of figures in the book. For instance, in Côte d'Ivoire, the Bourse du Café et Cacao, sorry about my French, each member gets or has got 3.3 million CFA to attend a board meeting, and the boss has earned £31,000 or $38,000 a month on that. So would that be an example of where such a system as a marketing board doesn't work?
Certainly, yes. I think it's important since Laurent Gbagbo was left power last year. All those cocoa institutions have been abolished, or I think they were abolished slightly before he left. So the cocoa situation in Côte d'Ivoire is currently in a state of flux, and they're considering a cocoa marketing board similar to the one that's in Ghana.
Right.
But in a way, how well that serves Ivorian farmers really depends on how well the Ivorian government wants it to serve its farmers.
Yes.
One thing that struck me, because you have these two systems. Ghana, part of the IMF and World Bank reforms in the 90s, there was a huge push to get rid of marketing boards across Africa. Ghana, I think largely because it was instituting a lot of other reforms and it had established itself as a democracy, was able to resist that demand to get rid of its marketing board. It kept its marketing board. Côte d'Ivoire, which was heavily in debt, and didn't have a strong negotiating hand, got rid of its marketing board. So for years, you've been able to see these two systems grow side by side, mm-hmm. one of which is free market, you know, one of which is the marketing board. And it's been very interesting to see sort of how they've developed. What's really interesting about it, it's hard to say in a very straightforward way, the marketing board system is definitely better. Because I don't think, given all the political turmoil, that's Côte d'Ivoire has experienced since the coup in 1999, so in the past 15 years. I don't think, no matter what system they'd had, the farmer wouldn't have been well off because the governments of those time have only ever been interested in stealing the cocoa money. They've only ever been interested in taking the money for themselves, giving the farmers as little as they could get away with. And even when they got rid of the marketing board, they just put all these other institutions in place to take the money from the farmer. So if you want to steal money from the farmer, you will find a way to do it. Mm. And whether or not the cocoa marketing, the marketing board that Côte d'Ivoire introduces you know, works for farmers, really does come down to if Cote d'Ivoire wants it to work for farmers. Mm. So I've always, I found that sort of interplay between sort of, in a way, economics and politics really, really fascinating. Because yes, you know, you can be in an office in Washington or London and say, yes, that's exactly what farmers should do. That's what these countries need. And, you know, it comes down to, you know, it depends on sort of how things work on the ground can be very, very different.
We're running out of time, so we've got one other issue I really wanted to touch on, and that's the an issue that, that several charities in the developed world have often picked up on when it comes to the cocoa industry, and that's child labour. And in your book, you have a very nuanced treatment of this, suggesting that some of the more egregious examples that might be dug up by charities may not be all that they seem, but you certainly don't shy away from the fact that there are issues connected with child labour in cocoa growing.
It was certainly one of the biggest stories to the cocoa sector when I was there. And it's a story that really rattles most Ghanaians and Ivorians. I mean, it annoys them for a few reasons, one of which they are genuinely afraid that people in the West will start buying their cocoa, will stop buying their cocoa, and then, you know, they won't have any money. But it also annoys them in the sense of, I guess, as would annoy anybody, this perception that, do you really think we'd put our children into slavery? Is that how, you know, is that how low of an opinion you have of us that, you know, you think you'd put our children into slavery? And I've certainly read some amazing, shocking things on, you know, on news websites about, you know, figures that seem to have just come out of nowhere about how many children are meant to be working in slavery in Ghana and Ivory Coast and Cote d'Ivoire and cocoa farms, figures that have bear no relation to reality. It's really interesting because there are certainly a lot of children working on cocoa farms, but the vast, vast majority of them are working with their families and an awful lot of them are in school. I find it hard to say that there's anything particularly wrong with that. There are certainly some children who are slaves, but there's that's a very, very tiny percentage. And also, when we talk about slaves, what we're talking about is, in a way, a distortion of a traditional system of apprenticeship, where children from poor families would be sent to work as house girls on fishing boats or on farms to learn a skill which could then help take them into adulthood and, you know, help them earn money. And some of these children are well treated and some of them aren't. And that's true whether they end up as a house girl in a middle class family in Accra or whether they end up on a fishing boat or, you know, whether they end up on a cocoa farm. I think when you're looking at the issue of the broader issue of children working on farms, I think the way these farms are structured with sort of, you know, you're looking at a farmer who's maybe 4 or 5 hectares of land, you know, he, you know, maybe harvests 2 or 3 bags of cocoa a year, $100 each. He doesn't really use insecticide, some people would argue, is he really a farmer or does he just go around gathering the cocoa pods? Mm-hmm. You know, because farming can imply a level of skill which isn't necessarily apparent on the ground. But as long as cocoa is done like that, then yes, there probably will always be children. Mm. There probably will always be children.
Members of an extended family. Just like if my parents were running a post office or a shop, you know, occasionally I'd help out stocking the shelves or something.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's a very difficult subject because every child has a right to an education. And, you know, if there was any sense that sort of a child has been kept on a cocoa farm, being kept out of school, then that's clearly wrong. But when you're looking at it, when you're looking at the best way to tackle this, I think somehow exaggerating the numbers or exaggerating the reality, all it does is, in my experience anyway, is annoy people in Ghana and Ivory Coast because they just sort of feel it's another example of how Westerners don't really understand what's happening here, how they, you know, just think the worst of us. And it doesn't, it obscures the whole issue. And I don't think, you know, and I think it's certainly true that when you talk to people who worked in, I think when I spoke to the IOM, the International Organization of Migration, about this issue, they were quite clear that there is a problem with child slavery in Ghana, but it's in the fishing industry. But the fishing industry is entirely local, you know. They're not producing a good which is sort of sold in a Western market. And NGOs don't tend to jump on the fishing industry. You know, they've jumped on the chocolate industry.
Again, and it comes back to what that symbolizes.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, you know, I can understand the motivation and why that might be an attractive thing to do. But then you just have to ask, what does it really serve to do this? You know, to exaggerate a problem, to make it out to be worse than it is. And if you're thinking of sort of how you genuinely reduce the instance of children, of child labour on farms, then you have to be looking at a much, you know, you're really looking at how the industry is structured. You know, you're moving it beyond the sort of family farms, you know, where, you know, people don't use fertilizer, they don't use insecticide, they just maybe harvest 2 or 3 bags a year and they don't make any money from it. You need to sort of move it into not necessarily large plantations, but into something which is essentially run more like a business, you know,
more and then structured.
Yeah, something which is run more like a business where you don't have kids running around. So yeah, I found it a very complicated. I found it a very complicated and difficult issue to write about. And every time, just when I thought I'd figured it out, I'd speak to someone or sort of speak to someone who sort of changed my mind and made me think that that I got it wrong.
Well, in my experience, the more complicated something seems, the more you actually know about it. If something's simple, then you really haven't understood it. I mean, that's a fascinating take on the child slavery bit, but it's a fascinating book anyway on quite an extraordinary subject that yeah, as you said, it's difficult to extrapolate, but, you know, perhaps speaks to some of the other debates about about development and about produce and about economics in the rest of Africa.
Yeah.
But anyway, just to finish up, I did warn you earlier on that I was going to ask you the question about, have you got a favourite place in Africa?
I'm not sure that I do. I've lived in Uganda and I've lived in Ghana. And before I went to both countries, people said, the two nicest places in Africa are Uganda and Ghana. You know, people are really friendly and, you know, they're great places to live. And that's really very true of both of them. They're really great. They're great countries and, you know, and I really miss living in both of them. You know, I think about them a lot and I think about people I met there and I'm always trying to get back to Africa in some shape or form. But yeah, so, and I think obviously when you live someplace even more, you've a tighter connection to it. I've obviously been to beautiful places sort of elsewhere on the continent, but I think I tie it between Uganda and Ghana because I lived in both of those places and I feel I know them quite well and, you know, I have a lot of great memories from them. And I hope to go back to Ghana this year. But so maybe Ghana slightly edges above Uganda.
If only through anticipation.
Yes.
Exactly. Anyway, thank you so much for coming in. That's been fascinating.
No, thanks for having me.
And that was Orla Ryan explaining how one of the world's most fated customer products has such an impact on the ground in West Africa. This is Nicholas Walton wishing you a good day from here in London, and thank you for listening to New Books in African Studies.